Hello, and welcome to End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Jenna Kerr.
Tim Phillips.
And End Credits is your local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here in our temporary new home for the summer, Thursdays at 10 a.m., to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the action movie with a heart of gold, Baby Driver. And that will be in the back half of the show. For the first half, we are going to talk about some of the things that have been making news this week, including the Oscars. They are still about half a year away, but the upcoming release of War for the Planet of the Apes has gotten some people wondering if the Academy should make a change to honor its motion capture mastery. And then we will talk about expanded universe fatigue. We've got Marvel, DC, Dark Universe, etc., 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 and now they are talking about a James Bond extended universe. Are we getting a little crazy with these movie series? But first, and this is along very similar lines, there was a disturbance in the Force. Last week, it is coming from the set of the Han Solo movie. And for those of you who don't have your thumb on all the latest Star Wars news, there is a Han Solo movie in development. It's about young Han Solo. It stars Alden Ehrenreich, who you may recognize as the cowboy actor from Hail Caesar. He plays the young Han Solo. The movie is being directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are famous for the 21 Jump Street series, as well as the Lego movie. And Lawrence Kasdan is the screenwriter on it. He wrote what is arguably the best Star Wars movie, which is The Empire Strikes Back, but he also co-wrote Return of the Jedi, as well as The Force Awakens. And all this came together in a conflict situation a couple of weeks ago, where Lord and Miller were suddenly and unceremoniously fired from the Han Solo movie, seemingly because they were taking great liberties with the script, a lot of improvisation allegedly on set. We don't know the full story, but it's sort of come out in drips and drabs from sources. In any event, Ron Howard will finish the movie off. It was 3 weeks away from being finished, oddly enough, but now it's, I think there's about a month and a half of reshoots they have planned. But we'll start with Tim, because Tim is a filmmaker, so I'm sure he has an opinion on all these developments. Being a filmmaker yourself, Tim, and you know, seeing what's happened to Lord and Miller, who were obviously hired because of a track record and because they're young up-and-coming filmmakers who do have their own fan base, but here they are out of work on Han Solo. Seemingly because they weren't carrying water for what the production wanted.
Right, yeah, and I think it comes down to like a workplace issue. You know, we often watch films and we're fans of films and we look and we think about the stories and the acting and the escape that comes from a film, but we're not really thinking about all the back-end things that go on, like that happen in your average workplace, really. The fact that Phil Lord and Chris Miller were hired to do a job and they had two bosses, Kathleen Kennedy, producer with a track record of E.T., Jurassic Park, The Sixth Sense, and Star Wars The Force Awakens, which revitalized the franchise. And then you have Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote Han Solo, the new film, and he's written, as you said, The Empire Strikes Back, which is considered the best Star Wars movie of all time by many people, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Return of the Jedi, and he also wrote Star Wars The Force Awakens. Mm-hmm. Once again, that was the film that revitalized the whole franchise. So he probably does not want anyone taking liberties with his script, and he probably has a good reason to do so given his track record. So Phil Lord and Chris Miller, it's unfortunate because they're really creative guys. You know, they did the Lego movie, great humor in that. They have a great track record. 21 Jump Street, very funny movie as well. But they're from a school of improvisation where they want their actors, you know, to go off script. And when you've got millions and billions invested in the franchise, it's tough to have people go off script. Because even given the past track record of Kathleen Kennedy and Lawrence Kasdan, they have one major Star Wars flop that could put a detour in their career. So,
yeah.
You know, it's that workplace environment where they kind of have to align with what their bosses are saying, which is unfortunate. and it'd be great to see them do some other more original stuff, more comedic or even dramatic that's more original. We can get some more original stories ideas out there as well.
Yeah.
And I think you can be caught captive in that environment, and that's probably what happened with them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you're talking about is they're working at a workplace kind of to the point that it's just Disney. There's no forget their credit.
That's right.
At the end of the day, everything has to be Disney. Mm-hmm. That's the boss. It's right. Not just Kathleen Kennedy either.
Yeah.
And it's not like George Lucas is directing the movie either. So there's not going to be a distinct vision anymore. Mm-hmm. The franchise has become so fragmented, and all of the other, you know, iterations, even by George Lucas himself, have, you know, very varied artistic merit.
Right.
And now they're just capitalizing on the brand itself and actually doing something interesting with the character of Han Solo and his early life,
mm-hmm.
improvised in that way that those directors like might even create a story that's maybe a little subversive. Who right. we don't know.
Yeah.
We have no idea why they're cutting the plug on that and putting in Ron Howard.
Yeah,
this is
the safest.
This is the baby boomer, you know,
yeah.
emergency director.
Mm-hmm. yeah. Cocoon 2.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think I might like Ron Howard a little bit better than Jenna, but but I mean it is interesting. To go off what you said about the Han Solo and Lord and Miller, you know, they were a surprising pick because they do have a record of sort of taking these things and going against expectations. When you heard about the Lego movie, think about, you know, when you heard they're making a Lego movie,
mm-hmm.
and what was your thought? You're like, it wasn't like, oh, this is going to be a great subversive comedy that's going to be pay tribute to the toy while also being like a great original story. No, you thought, well, you know, here they are, corporate, blah blah blah, rubber stamp. And I'm not sure what they thought they were going to get out of Han Solo. I think they thought they were going to get the name brand of Lord and Miller.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side of it is, though, you have Rian Johnson who's making the next film in the series, which features the ongoing adventures of Rey and Finn and BB-8 and all those. Mm-hmm. Rian Johnson, of course, director of Brick. Awesome
50
movie.
Days of Summer. Was that?
Mark Webb.
But, oh, no,
He was also Brothers Bloom and Looper.
Yeah.
And he also directed several episodes of Breaking Bad. So this is another one of those directors who you would think there might be some creative, mm-hmm. you know, friction. But he seems to be, you know, doing quite all right for himself. And that does surprise me a bit because when I heard he was named the director, it's like, well, I'd rather see the next Rian Johnson movie than see Rian Johnson direct the Star Wars movie. Because I do feel like, as Jenna said, mm-hmm. these things kind of make themselves.
They do, yeah. And they could use their voices for original projects.
Mm-hmm.
And with Rian Johnson, the interesting thing is the Breaking Bad episode he did that he got a lot of flack for was The Fly.
Mm.
The one in one room.
One room where there's basically, just a fly buzzing around. And try doing something that minimalist with Star Wars and see what happens, right?
Well, let's let him do it. I feel like there are exceptions with some directors that enter through the studio system kind of and make big mm-hmm. budget movies like Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
And they still kind of maintain a bit of what they're about
mm-hmm.
On top of the other intentions going on with the stakeholders.
Right.
So maybe Rian Johnson is like going to be the salvation. There's going to be a really weird trilogy coming out.
But I do like what you said about Christopher Nolan, but I do think he's the exception rather than the rule.
He might be.
Because he can walk into the studio and say, I want to make a film about the retreat from Dunkirk, and they're like, okay, here's a check. I'm not sure you can do that if you're even Lord and Miller or Rian Johnson or even people who are like established. Like, when was the last time you saw a John Carpenter movie?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's been a while.
Yeah, I think it was The Ward, which came out in like 2011.
But even great directors like Steven Spielberg, who have built their name on these amazing blockbusters,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a contemporary of the Star Wars period, where things were just going nuts at the box office, but with just like these directors that were box office gold
mm-hmm.
and repeating the same results over and over. His career has kind of petered out too. Same with George mm-hmm. Lucas. Like there's a lot more variation and, you know, who knows with anything that he makes. He's just got the license to do it, you know.
Yeah, and I do remember hearing stories about Spielberg having difficulty getting Lincoln going because you would think Steven Spielberg, Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
No-brainer. Well, moving on, this is an interesting topic that I did want to bring up. It sort of plays into the movie coming out very soon, War for the Planet of the Apes, the third movie since they kind of rebooted that franchise, speaking of franchises. But there was an article on the In Contention blog at Variety about whether or not they should bring back the Special Achievement Oscar for Andy Serkis. Andy Serkis, of course, is a pioneer for motion capture. He plays the main ape in the Planet of the Apes movies, but he also did Gollum in Lord of the Rings. He also did King Kong in Peter Jackson's King Kong. He also did the Captain in the Adventures of Tintin movie. And he also has a studio in London where he teaches other people how to be motion capture actors. I think this is an interesting debate to me, first because I think Christopher Tapley pointed out that does he get sole credit for a motion capture performance, or is that like a co-credit with like the visual effects artist? But I remember back in The Lord of the Rings when that was coming out, people were saying, forget special achievement or technical Oscars. He should be getting like a Best Supporting Actor Oscar, which, you know, regardless of the tools, you know, the costume designer doesn't get credit for the costume the Best Supporting Actor wears.
Or the makeup designer.
Yeah.
That all the actors whose makeup, all the actors in a film wear. But I think this is very, it's very in the same vein as the issue with the directors of the Han Solo film. The ways that movies are being made now have changed so dramatically, and now there's so many more people involved in doing something that jobs that didn't exist previously.
Right.
And this is Andy Serkis as the pioneer kind of that style, that specific, you know, job that actors, many of them, have to do. So they did give a special achievement Oscars to like Shirley Temple and Judy Garland because they didn't want to include her in the regular acting category for The Wizard of Oz, and Marnie Nixon, who sang for countless movie musicals, where big name stars like Audrey Hepburn and Natalie Wood were dubbed by her in Oscar-winning films. So it's like just a nice thing to do for Andy Serkis, and I think that's what they're talking about. It would, you know, they did also give honorary Oscars to people like Peter O'Toole, or people just for having a long and accomplished career.
Yeah, there are honorary lifetime achievement Oscars.
Yeah, they just do it like as one-offs. Yeah. But I don't see why they. Maybe the issue is that they want to start new categories, basically, completely.
I don't want them to start new categories in the Oscar telecast. It's like 4 hours already of just waiting patiently for something to happen, it seems like, whenever they have or every year on the Oscars.
But to make Jenna's point, that's where the visual effects Oscar came from and the sound design Oscar came from, is they started as special categories, and then they were like, well, we're kind of getting new achievements in this every year. It would make sense to just create a category to honor that every year, since we're kind of doing it anyway.
I think people should be recognized for a lot of different things when it comes to film, and I think they probably are in these different guilds, have the different awards. But I would like to see, like when it comes to this, I think just adding on to another category at the Oscars may just add time to the broadcast.
I think that's what bothers everyone, though, at the end of the day.
I think he probably deserves it. A bigger debate would be whether he deserves to be up for, like, an actor award, or does a voice actor in an animated film deserve to be up for an actor award, which I kind of have some issues with that. Because, like, in an animated film, you're doing great voice work, like we're doing right here on the radio. But is this, like...
Is it Oscar-worthy?
Oscar-worthy, what we're doing right now.
This is Oscar-worthy radio.
You need to have a radio category in the Academy of Awards for motion pictures.
Yeah. But you bring up voice, and a lot of people... there was the Spike Jonze movie Her a couple of years ago, and a lot of people thought Scarlett Johansson should have got a nomination for being the disembodied voice of the operating system.
Robin Williams in Aladdin.
Sure.
That was when it kind of started to happen, because Beauty and the Beast had been nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So everyone thought that the industry was going to change that much, that animated movies would become a much bigger deal, and they have. So to some extent, like maybe 50-50 of everything is just digital now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Oscars have so many issues because they expanded it to 10 Best Picture films. And for whatever reason, they only pick 9 every year.
It has to do with the point system that it's a math problem, which is weird because it's the movies, but go ahead.
And it was supposed to include like more animated films supposed to be nominated or documentaries. And you never see animated films, documentaries, very rarely, or a foreign film in the Best Picture category. So
right, it came out of the Dark Knight, you know, because the Dark Knight didn't get, everyone thought the Dark Knight should have got a Best Picture Oscar, but it didn't. So they thought expanding it would allow for more, like maybe the rare blockbuster that is a piece of art as well that you wouldn't normally consider an Oscar movie.
Right, and going back to Andy Serkis, though, with the motion capture, I just feel like it would be great to recognize him for this. And they do have that awards day where they come on and they say, okay, yesterday at the scientific awards, the technical awards, we gave out these Oscars. And maybe adding something like that to those awards would add some just entertainment value to it. And then maybe you can broadcast that, because they're always looking for content to broadcast and new award shows. So maybe if that was included, or, you know, it would just add some more appeal to it, some more, you know, sexiness to the whole ceremony.
And that's really what it's all about, is just getting the Dark Knight more nomination potential at the end of the day. Because that's how they're going to get people to watch the show for 4 hours.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm with you in that, because they did expand the categories, but there hasn't been a Best Picture nominee for animated movies since Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there have been a lot of really great animated movies. Like something like Up comes to mind, mm-hmm. where the first 5 minutes of that movie are just so heartbreaking. They're so emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first 5 minutes of Up should have been Oscar nominated. But yeah, it just seems like we want to put stuff in their own categories, so we create other categories. My preference would actually be, I think he should get a best. I mean, I haven't seen War for the Planet of the Apes yet, but it has been a rave. And certainly judging from his work in the first two Apes movies, I would bet dollars to donuts he would be a legitimate contender for best actor for War of the Planet of the Apes, which would be, you know, would be tremendous. Because, again, dealing with the issue of getting people to tune in, who wouldn't want to tune in to see if Andy Serkis won the Oscar for playing a talking ape leading an ape resistance against the human race? That would make people tune in, absolutely. And, you know, I think it is a question. I think the fine line is whether Joe Lettieri of the studio Weta, who's sort of done the visual effects for all these movies, whether that's kind of like a co-credit, because, you know, certainly without Andy Serkis's base, you wouldn't get the great performance, but you wouldn't get the realism of playing like an ape or a robot or, you know, some other glee blob or whatever you're playing, if not for the visual effects artists on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's, again, like, even in the first iteration of the Planet of the Apes films, the actors were acting through like a lot of makeup.
Oh, yeah.
You can't even see their face moving. So, you know, then it's like just a voice performance too. But that was one of the impressive aspects of that franchise.
Yeah, it comes back to like makeup, like you said. I think of an old film, The Elephant Man.
Mm.
John Hurt, who played The Elephant Man, was up for Best Actor.
You hardly see his face.
Yeah, and he did a great job acting, it seemed like. But a lot of it probably is you're feeling bad for this guy who's deformed, and you see that on screen. And so makeup right now can affect performances. So so maybe like the visual effects is just like the visual makeup, and that's what he said.
Of course, you know, Andy, like the makeup itself, like the physical makeup, that's a dying art. Unless you're Greg Nicotero making like thousands of zombies a year on The Walking Dead, there actually isn't a lot of work for makeup artists now, which is sad.
Mm-hmm.
Like Rick Baker, who designed a lot of the ape effects for the Burton Planet of the Apes, he had to retire. And it's not because he wanted to, it's because there was no work anymore. for this guy who's won Oscars. And
that was,
you know,
the last chance.
Yeah. So I mean, that's another kind of, I think that's maybe another topic entirely, like the lost art of things.
It's a big issue.
It is a big issue.
You know, it's not just about Andy Serkis getting an Oscar here. It's about the whole nature of the medium changing.
Absolutely. Speaking of mediums changing, we're talking about franchise fatigue.
And topics changing.
I know. Just got to keep
great
going. Got to keep the show flowing. Now that we're in the 10 a.m. slot, we can't have this like lazy, laid back discussion we have at 8 a.m. But the extended universe fever, let's call it. And I made a list sort of like off the top of my head of all these like various extended universes they're working on. There's like Marvel, of course. There's DC. There's the Dark Universe, which The Mummy, that was part of the Dark Universe. Star Wars, Transformers. There are X-Men, Spider-Man, which are kind of subsidiaries of the Marvel Universe. Harry Potter. It seems like Hollywood has gone extended universe crazy. And you know, I think in as much as fans seem to be responding, at least to what Marvel's doing, I think we're reaching critical fatigue when we're talking about like doing James Bond extended universe, because it's a universe named after the one guy. And you know, I do wonder how does that end? Like, do we get like Felix Leiter movies? Do we get like Moneypenny movies? Do we get like Q movies? I don't know.
That would be amazing. And they're all like motion captured performances.
They are. Andy Serkis is playing every role.
Yeah.
I think
it's
I wouldn't mind seeing that.
Reality,
yeah.
That is probably very close at hand.
Andy Serkis got to eat, but yeah.
What's the new James Bond?
Yeah. That would be an unusual choice.
Yeah.
And then you could do like Sean Connery. You could have like the motion capture Sean Connery played by Andy Serkis as James Bond, and they could set it in the 1960s. Okay, we've solved Hollywood. There we go.
But I think with... what were we talking about?
The extended universe.
We just solved Hollywood. There's nothing else to say.
We solved it. I think, they're getting too obsessed with these movie universes. It's just, you know... I remember when I was a kid, actually, like I'm going back, I'm getting old now, but when I was a kid, I used to collect comic books, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I used to think, oh, it'd be so cool if they really treated comic books the way they treat like these real dramatic movies, these mafia movies or something, that you'd really see the backstories of the characters and everything. And now I think we've gotten to a point where it's just overload,
mm-hmm.
and so much for marketing purposes, right? Like, I saw a movie I liked was Deadpool, because it really was irreverent when it came to the superhero genre. And then there were a couple characters in it, and they did a good job. I'm not sure who the characters are, but they felt like they were kind of placed in there because they had to place the two.
Yeah,
that's Marvel, right? Was that Marvel or
yeah?
They had to place the two Marvel characters in there to keep the universe going for future films, and it just didn't feel like it flowed with the story as well. And I just think with that universe, I guess it's doing well at the box office, but at a certain point it might collapse on itself if you just keep, you know, inserting characters without there being you know, a standalone story to it.
Yeah,
it's my thought.
I'm just overwhelmed by all of it. I feel like everything's either a remake or a spinoff, or you guys say extended universes. It's called a spinoff.
Yeah, it's like in TV, it was a spinoff.
Yeah.
But that's right. I mean, the nomenclature has changed, right? Because you used to say that. If you know, you have a successful series of X-Men movies, then you spin off Wolverine, you spin off Deadpool. But now it's an extended universe. But then you go on TV and it's like there's, you know, six... the NCIS shows, but you don't call it the NCIS Extended Universe.
Yeah, I know.
or the you know, old Dick Wolf Chicago shows. It's not the Chicago Extended Universe or something.
Yeah.
But
now it is. I mean, I guess everything is anything goes, and if you have an imagination and can connect it to something that has, you know, already existing fan base, mm-hmm. you better do it. Like
right. It's the cash cow, right? You want to just keep pumping that out. And it'd be great to see more original stories. So, like, come up with just an original superhero story or something. That'd be pretty cool,
Well, you're right about cash cow, because... And it's not even, like, North American money, because you have something like Transformers, which has made like $89 million in the United States so far, but it's made $200 million worldwide. The Mummy has made $72 million in North America, but over $300 million worldwide. So it's not even about, you know, telling movies to a North American audience anymore. It's about having something that can, you know, you can dub and then fire off to China and Japan and India and England and Germany and all these other places. Mm-hmm. It's almost like pure business in the show business now. It's not even about the show necessarily.
Yeah, no, just saying the name Mummy, like that's kind of a remake, but it's not. It's just like people know what a mummy is and what kind of movie they're going to go see.
Right.
And there's Tom Cruise, so that's all that's all that's required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tom Cruise, Mummy. take my money. Yeah.
And Jenna made a great point, how everything's getting more digital and the way we're watching. So when people are going out to a movie theater and spending money, they're like, I don't spend money on anything. I don't spend money on music. I can download movies for free or whatever. If I'm going to a theater, they want to see those big movies. And then it seems like Netflix and TV now is going where the stories are. And but even with that, it's like I kind of miss just like, don't miss it because they're still there, but like movies between like an hour and a half and 3 hours, standalone.
Yeah.
And that's what you get, right? And because with TV shows now, Netflix, it's like, okay, I'm going to binge watch this for 58 hours here, and then I'll get to the bottom of it. Or with the movie universes, okay, I'm going to watch X, Y, Z, all these different films and try to connect the dots, whereas it's great when you can just see something as, you know, a work of cinema that's just, you know, but you know, that might be going away a little bit, but
I think it's all just like all our consciousness is changing completely. So the kinds of movies that we can sit through are totally changing, and the way that they're created is changing. Mm-hmm. Also, the way we consume it will be changing. We don't get to see every single independent movie that's produced because there's no easy way to access it. Mm-hmm. Big budgets. Studio business does not want to support that from happening. So if it's going to be something that's controllable like Netflix or just regular distribution and 3D ticket prices, that's where all the jobs are, basically, for everyone. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's you're right about it. Does seem like they're the mid-budget sort of movies, like The Girl on the Train that came out last year. It seems like we're getting fewer and fewer of those. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Girl on the Train, whatever you think of the quality of that film, I didn't think much of it. But you don't get that as much, where you go in and see a movie and it's a beginning, middle, and the end, and you don't have to wait through the credits to see what, you know, what teas they're going to have for Girl on the Train Part 2 or Boy on the Train, the expanded universe version of it, or Guy on the Plane or whatever it is, Snakes on a Plane. But it just seems like, you're right, TV, and to tie this back to what we were talking about at the beginning, someone like Steven Soderbergh, I mean, he has another movie coming out in a couple of weeks in the movie theater, but he was saying, you know, I can't make movies anymore. I can't walk into a studio and pitch them on something, and then they'll give me a check, and away I go. And that's why he went to TV. That's why he took Behind the Candelabra to TV. That's why he did The Nick for 2 seasons, because that's the only place he could do, like, more quote-unquote adult storytelling, it seems. And, there's definitely a reversal there. Anyway. Speaking of more adult storytelling, we actually have, what people will appreciate the originality of this movie. And to get us there, it's a little classic Simon and Garfunkel ditty, and the name says it all. We will be right back with our review of Baby Driver. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
start in the AM questions.
I got a question, Doc. Why would I believe phones over here heard a goddamn word you said? You lay down your whole play. He ain't even listening. Baby.
The target is an armored truck at Perimeter Trust in Dunwoody, 10 a.m. sharp. We have the details of the route because someone at the depot has a nasal problem. The bank itself is right near the Buford Highway, so we should be able to hit the ramp within 60 seconds of getting out. We also have a diversion crew. They're going to blow up a bread truck a ways away, keep the fuzz busy. The dress code is the Michael Myers Halloween mask, but don't all buy your mask at the same time. It looks suspicious. The switch car is ready, but you want me to hit the long stay parking structure at Hartsfield Jackson to get a heist vehicle that stays colder longer? Boost a commuter car, a family car, something that blends in well with morning traffic. Something on the heavy side, in case we need to ram the cops off the road, a Escalade, Yukon, Avalanche, whatever. It needs to be ready for an 8:30 start in the AM. Questions?
Well, ain't y'all cute?
That's my baby.
And that was from Baby Driver, the new film from Edgar Wright. It stars Ansel Elgort, Lily James, John Hamm, Jamie Foxx, and Kevin Spacey. I love that scene because not because he's able to the setup is Kevin Spacey's laying out this plan for robbing an armored car, and he's listening to his iPod because he has tinnitus, and the music drowns out the humming in his ear. But the best part of the scene is when he's regurgitating back, as you saw there, and Kevin Spacey's looking at the gang. He's like the proud father of this kid, and it's such a great little scene, and I think that's one of the benefits of this movie. And I know, Tim, you had some concerns. I have some concerns as well. I'm sure Jenna has. Mm-hmm. But just to start off, this is such a great cast doing some great work. Kevin Spacey, I think, is like right in his wheelhouse between charming and menacing. And Ansel Elgort, who I only know from, I think, the Divergent movies. That's the YA series he was a part of.
I don't know him, yeah.
Yeah, it's... Believe me, you can live without the Divergent movies. I have seen all three. I don't know why. But
I've seen one, too. I don't know why. I still don't remember him.
But I'll say this about the first one. It had a great Junkie XL soundtrack. But, I did not think this kid was capable of this. I mean, I'm sure he probably was, but he is particularly great in this movie. In a part that could have, you know, just kind of looked as wooden and kind of a very stale. But the cast in this, I think, is just great overall.
Yeah, he kind of reminded me of a very young Joseph Cotten in this movie. Like, he was a perfect film noir hero.
Yeah.
At the same time as being an action hero and a cowboy. And, and very, you know, a sensitive presence that really was worthy of the title role, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a weird name for a movie, too, and I really had no idea what to expect without delving into it beforehand, but it's just a very strange postmodern take on a genre film.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people will like it, but some people will think it's kind of strange. Some audiences might feel alienated by it. But what excited me the most, I think one of the strongest like overall qualities of this is just being like just a great shoot 'em up car chase film.
Yeah.
Like with some excellent, I'm hoping, analog car chases where you get to see stuff hit and blown up, and I wasn't falling asleep. It was a lot of character-driven storytelling, but not a lot of dialogue. And seeing things told visually as well as orally with an amazing soundtrack is really what kept it its pace up, and it kept me not really knowing what was going to happen next.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I thought it was a great film, and Ansel Elgort, like you, Jenna, I did not know who he was. I still have to look at my page to get that last name right, but I thought he did a great job, and he has this look to me that he's like every kid. Like, there's a lot of kids like 18 to 22 that look like him, so I felt like, but he's good looking, but there's, you know, I thought he had a a good look to him that made him
just young, like
the look of innocence, yeah, like the baby, yeah. The baby driver, and I thought the stunt scenes were amazing. I thought the acting was really good as well, and I really liked the soundtrack. And I think the soundtrack said more about the director than maybe than the lead character would be listening to, because there's
probably,
you know, so much from like the 90s, and I guess I read somewhere that Edgar Wright came up with this idea like 1994, so you can see why, like, he starts with Bell Bottoms, John Spencer Blues Explosion in the opening credits, and I thought that was a great scene with that, and it was a great use of a soundtrack with a car chase at the same time, and those are two staples of cinema, which even as we digitize it, I don't think they're going to go anywhere anytime soon.
It's interesting. I didn't know about the 90s thing, about him like having come up with this idea in the 90s, because now that you mention it, it does have a very feel like of, like everybody after seeing Pulp Fiction had like their own kind of Pulp Fiction idea.
Right.
And some of them were good, some of them were not so good, but I think this sort of benefits from having been made almost, well, it's actually over 20 years later. But the thing I liked about it is... To go further with what Jenna said about the action scenes, there's a chase scene later on where he's on foot.
Yes.
And it seems like it's more of a dance. It's as much a dance as it is a chase.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's so much of the physical movement in this. And I saw the credit, and I wish I remembered to write down who the choreographer was. I looked it up later. But there's a choreography credit when you're watching the end credits, and you're like, is there going to be a lot of dancing in this? Is it like La La Land?
But then
as you're seeing sort of the story unfold and the way he moves, even just going get the coffee in that first scene, it is very dance. And I wonder how much staging went into that. Even just him walking down the street to get coffee.
Yeah.
The movement is so fluid. And it is really as much a dance sequence as it is like a sort of like a crazy parkour action sequence of, you know, running off of tables and running down escalators. And it is amazing. And I think as Jenna said, I do think it was all the driving was all done in camera. Mm-hmm. I think that was all stunt drivers. I don't think there was much.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like there's much digital stuff, probably on some of the later action scenes where, you know, people are up high and things are on fire. Mm-hmm. But it's just feels like pure filmmaking, which is a genuine treat now. And the story has beginning, middle, and end. I don't know what, you know, Edgar Wright might have planned further, but it is a complete story that you get at the end. And like I said, the actors are great. Jamie Foxx, I can't remember the last time I saw Jamie Foxx like performance where he wasn't just doing Jamie Foxx.
Mm-hmm.
John Hamm, who's, you know, typically known as, you know, from his Don Draper days as, you know, leading man quality, square jaw and all that stuff. This sort of makes you wonder, you know, where has he been since the end of Mad Men? You know, why isn't he, you know, doing more acting stuff?
Yeah.
Spacey, I loved a lot. Lily James, she was cute, but I mean, this gets into one of my criticisms. It's like, I don't feel like she was really a completed character.
That was probably one of my number one criticisms too. I she wasn't one of their major date scenes, like has no dialogue. It's kind of a part of the dance like quality of the editing and the style. But even as just kind of a femme fatale or even the love interest, she kind of felt short for me. She was very cute, but that's it. Like, it was probably very hard to cast someone opposite their lead who wasn't going to be like too beautiful or, you know, have an overpowering presence to be the baby's romantic interest, you know.
I kind of liked some of the quirks of her character, the fact that she listened to music just like him constantly, and I thought, it probably wasn't fully fleshed out, really deep character, but a lot of the characters in it, even Baby to a certain extent, although you have all this past that they bring in, I don't know how fleshed out. You don't really see him getting emotional much or having real long dialogue scenes. And I thought for what it worked really well. But, you know, it's not a movie I would probably think of like a year from now, like, oh, wow, out, like, no. As far as the acting or anything goes. But as far as the action goes, I thought it was quite impressive. And the one character, actually, I really liked John Hamm a lot until near the end. And then I thought he's starting to fall into a bit of a caricature near the end. So that's... And that was actually one of my criticisms, was John Hamm near the end.
When it was just John Hamm near the end.
Yeah, John Hamm Terminator mode or something.
I did feel like Terminator a little bit, too.
I think there was a lot of stuff near the end. I think it does sort of start falling apart near the end. And there's a particular scene, I guess it's like shortly after the midpoint, where they go to make a pickup. And it feels like that's where the movie becomes more about the action and the plot and the crime stuff and less about the characters. It feels like it feels very character driven up until that point. And then after that, it sort of becomes, as you said, more of like Terminator, more straight up action.
But like you said, even the fact that she knew about music, that really was like the
was
defining
character.
Quality of all the characters, though, even of Baby. Like, that's the only kind of point of access we have into his psyche, is not what he says, what he's listening to. Mm-hmm. And it's like everybody in all the relationships in the movie feel that way, that they're sort of superficial, but at the same time, they're just there. They're treated like real life relationships, where you don't actually get to psychologically delve into a girl that you just meet. You know, she might mention a song or something that you might have in common, and then you hold on to that, and it makes you fall in love.
Right.
And that's what it was successful at doing, was giving me that feeling. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me, you mentioned even the opening credits of Breathless and like French New Wave movies. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, by the end credits, I did see the thank you to Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, too, buried in there.
Yeah.
And this definitely is a kind of movie that wouldn't exist without that kind of early postmodern film that Quentin Tarantino defined.
Yeah, you can see the influence was Quentin Tarantino, because before the very end credits, I was thinking, oh, he was probably influenced by Quentin Tarantino. You know, Baby, Buddy, they can't use their real names. That's like Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
And then you see that thank you at the end, then you kind of realize, okay, this is... And the use of music that Quentin Tarantino uses in all his films, you know, especially his early films like Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, where it was... 70s music, 60s. There was a lot of that type of music in this.
Yeah, there's a lot of pastiche of different mediums and just the way that a young person experiences the world now. And they really give that to the viewer, where it's just like different song all the time or different thing on the TV and you're flicking it. And, you know, it could get as weird or as specific as like a certain movie or random bullfight. And there was a lot of red in the movie, too. And that also reminded me of Quentin Tarantino. It had this graphic quality. Mm-hmm. And
there was always a red coupe
in every job.
It
could have been black and white, even.
Yeah. It's interesting, the music quality. Because, you're sort of experiencing the world through him. And of course, he's walking around with headphones on it. And it's really kind of, you see that all the time. And, I'm probably guilty of that, too.
Yeah.
Actually, I know I am. But that's kind of difficult to translate into the movies. But you do get that feeling walking around in your headphones all the time. And
like a soundtrack to the movie of your life.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think the movie does have some very subtle things to say about music and how we all interact with music and how we all have a connection with music, but also communication as well. I thought it was interesting they decided to make his foster father, Baby's foster father, deaf. So it's that he has this very, he lives with this very deep connection to the music he's listening to. But at the same time, it's something he can't experience with this person who means so much to him, who is deaf. But at the same time, they have great communication with the sign language and lip reading. I think there's probably some very deep analysis you can do about, you know, the nature of communication and knowing people by watching this movie. And I do think that's at least where the superficiality of the characters works, you know, for that benefit, because you do only ever know them by their nicknames. Mm-hmm. And you do, and that's really the kind of only how deep they can get because of the nature of their business. You know, you can't, you know, become best friends with the person you're knocking over banks with, obviously.
But those interesting dynamics between them really were the heart of any relationships that were going on.
I thought it was interesting it was based in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Of all the cities they could choose, they chose Atlanta, which it was you know, kind of cool in a way. I don't really have anything to say. I don't know why they chose Atlanta, but
yeah,
it's kind of cool to do something not Los Angeles, not New York, not Chicago, but Atlanta.
I did find that interesting too, because there's like there's no kind of musical connection to Atlanta. There's no kind of, you know, it's not like a cultural hub like those places you mentioned. It's very kind of, and I guess maybe that's it. It's very pad. It's very, it's one of those places that you go to turn into other places, you know, where, you know, like kind of like how Toronto is, although I think we would all agree Toronto has its own certain characteristics that we see as people who live not too far from Toronto. But I mean, Atlanta is one of those places where the movies go to turn into someplace else, because that's what Atlanta is. It's I guess perfectly bland in that respect.
Or it's like just the palette for a big pastiche of other movie tropes. Like there was pictures of freeways and stuff, and I'm like, it could be L.A. Like, I didn't even know it was Atlanta watching it. I was like, what is this? Is it London? Where are we? And it was a little disorienting, and but in a good way, because it was putting everything else in the forefront, just the story. It wasn't there was no distraction.
Yeah, they don't mention Atlanta. I don't think they, you know, there's no scene where somebody goes, "Welcome to Atlanta."
No.
But you know, you see it at the beginning. I think the bank they knocked over is like Atlanta Savings and Loan or something. And then there's a scene later on where they see the APD for Atlanta Police Department. But yeah, it's you're right. It's subtle though, and that does add to the any feeling USA kind of quality.
And he's lead character baby, he's in a shop and he gets an Atlanta tourist jacket or shirt or something when he's trying to disguise himself. So
that's right too. Not to harp too much on the music, but I think there's a lesson here in music editing, because they're using some lesser known songs. Example being the one we played just earlier, even though it's a Simon and Garfunkel hit, or maybe just on like a Simon and Garfunkel album, but there's a lot of well-known songs in this too. But it does seem kind of seamless. You know, when you're watching something like Guardians of the Galaxy, the music is kind of the star when the music comes on, and I definitely noticed that in the second Guardians more than the first one. But and then I'm thinking of something like Suicide Squad 2, which also uses music fairly heavily. But again, it seems like the scene is sort of edited to the music in a very overhanded way, where it sort of evokes more of a music video feel. And this I did not find distracting at all. It seemed to make sense, whether that was the action sort of fitting into the song or the song fitting into the action. I'm not sure which way Edgar Wright went to, but there is something, this seems to be definitely a trend of using like music people know and love as kind of a new kind of scoring for a film, because I don't remember any like original music from this film, but I think there's a lesson here in how to use music well as well.
Yeah, it went seamlessly and it went with the character, and he even incorporated it, like you're saying, in that early scene where he's dancing on the street to get coffee. They're playing the song Harlem Shuffle, and he's incorporating that into his dance. And it was really cool. You can see how it was choreographed. He's dancing in front of murals. He's incorporating what he sees on the murals into his dance. And so it's actually sort of announcing itself as being part of the movie, but it's not like I know what you're saying. You watch a movie and then the end credits roll or something. And there's this song, like, what does the song have to do with this movie? Yeah. You know, like, what does you know this have to do with Transformers or something?
Yeah.
You know, what I'm saying?
Yeah, nobody's slapping Linkin Park at the end of this.
Yeah.
The other thing,
I was just going to mention, now that I remember, actually, I thought they were going to play Be My Baby at one point, but maybe that's been used in films already too many times.
Mean Streets.
He's obviously very sensitive to that, too. And there's one more song that mentions a girl named Deborah by Pulp. I think it's called Disco 2000.
I love that song.
Yeah.
I said, why didn't they do, but maybe because Deborah wasn't in the title of the song? I don't know, but that's a great song. It's a great song, yeah.
I do find it interesting, and this is maybe getting on the wonkish side. Edgar Wright, and now that we discussed, kind of came up with the idea in the 90s, it's his first screenplay he's done solo. He's, you know, his previous works like Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead, World's End, he did those with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. Scott Pilgrim, I think he did with Joe Cornish. So, I mean, this is like pure Edgar Wright that we're seeing here.
And so he's emerging as an auteur.
I think so.
Finally into his own, like, in that category with Tarantino. And
yeah, and I think that's a fairly apt description, because when you're talking about the three, I think they're called the Cornholio Trilogy. Those are very pointed sort of parodies, satires of certain genres. Scott Pilgrim, of course, based on a graphic novel. And, you know, so I think this is a very specific sort of coming out of a director in his particular voice. And I think that makes it all the more interesting as a work. And it'll be interesting to see what he does next.
It'll be interesting to see where he goes from here. Yeah. I did read somewhere saying this is his most ambitious movie yet.
I believe it.
I kind of think, like, Shaun of the Dead, that's pretty ambitious, you know, for an early movie to do that kind of satire and that kind of, special effects, comedy all rolled into one. I thought that, you know, that's pretty cool to do on that kind of low budget as well. Mm-hmm. So I think the budget for this wasn't even, I looked it up, it was like $34 million. So it wasn't like outrageously high given today's Hollywood standards.
And it made it back on the weekend.
And I'm sure they'll make sequels now. And that's going to be what he meant by ambitious, because he created a kind of universe that can now just have all kinds of iterations. Mm-hmm. Even Tarantino himself wants to have spinoffs of Kill Bill and is working towards that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are going to be staples of pop cultural lexicon, and they'll be riffed on forever.
He was once talking about a Vega Brothers movie where he's going to get Michael Madsen and John Travolta together. I mean, we're probably 15 years too late for that, but you're right. And I think there
maybe digitally they'll do it though.
With motion capture.
Andy Serkis
as John Travolta.
John Travolta. He'll dance.
that might be interesting, but I do think there is sort of a unifying theory of that all Quentin Tarantino's movies take place in the same world.
Yeah.
So maybe. Yeah. So I think we're all very high on...
we're all very high right now, yeah.
We're all very high on Baby Driver.
On
the clouds of sounds wafting through the soundtrack and our subconscious.
Yeah.
To that. I was high on that movie. I drove to the movie, so when I drove home, I was like, okay.
Doing donuts in the parking lot and drifting.
I whipped my car to the front door to pick up my husband. Because I actually had a car. I rented a car for the weekend. Driving.
But to tie this in a bow, this was the project that Edgar Wright did instead of, you know, Ant-Man, which, you know, addressing what we said earlier in the show, you know, it's, I think we would have rather had this than see Edgar Wright's Ant-Man movie. And I think
that's the moral.
I think
that's
so,
the moral of the story. Anyway, that is all we're going to do for this week's end credits. And I will give my co-hosts a chance to plug their various doings on social media and other places. We'll start with Dim.
You can find Flash in the Deadpan, FLASH in the Deadpan. I've got a website, and you can find some films I've done on Vimeo under that moniker. Thank you.
Well, with me, I don't really have anything planned because I improvise everything I do, including some shows here on the air, sometimes on Thursday afternoon where you would see the Hydro or the Witching Hour. And I may be doing that again this week, maybe in a different time slot. Just tune in to CFRU 93.3 FM.
You never know when Jenna will appear on CFRU.
Yeah.
I write about movies, TV shows, and other nerdy stuff every day at nerdbastards.com, and I will be back later today at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back here next Thursday morning at 10 a.m. and every week after that, at least for the summertime. And we will have more end credits for you then next week. See you then.